Mr. Eric Lindstrom to argue for the appellate, and Mr. Frank Jacobini to argue for the appellate, and Mr. Marshall Jacobini also to argue for the appellate.
All right, gentlemen, welcome and thank you. Mr. Lindstrom.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I am Eric Lindstrom, representing the engineering defendants in this matter, RCS Enterprises, LP, and James Martin Montgomery. This is an appeal from, and we go from medicine to engineering. This, too, is an appeal of a denial of a motion to dismiss, this time based on what I call the Certificate of Merit statute, which is, of course, Section 150.002 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. The facts are really straightforward. In spite of the appellee's attempts to come back each time and try to justify their failure to file a certificate of merit with their initial complaint against the engineering defendants, in this case the appellants. There's no dispute that there was no certificate of merit filed with the first amended petition, which was filed in this case on February 22nd of this year. Under Section 150.002 in Sharp Engineering versus Luis, dismissal is mandatory because the statute requires the filing of a certificate of merit with your initial complaint. There's one exception which was not met in this case. That exception is Section 150.002C, and it provides that if the plaintiff alleges that within 10 days of the filing of the petition that the statute of limitations was about to expire, then and because of that reason they could not obtain, because of the time constraints, could not obtain a certificate of merit, then they're granted an automatic 30-day extension. The statute does say that 30 days can be extended if the court deems that there's just cause. The plaintiffs in this case, the appellees, did not allege anything with regard to the expiration of the statute of limitations and their failure to file a certificate of merit for that reason until approximately 77 days after they filed their first amended petition, which was the first pleading against the engineering defendants.
Let me ask this, though. Was there, I guess, second amended petition? Was it filed very shortly after?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and had the defendants been served at the time that they filed their first second petition?
I don't know if they had been served. I do know that it was filed before they answered. The second amended petition was filed before they answered. Of course, the very first answer filed by the defendants asserted the failure to file a certificate of merit and also challenged the sufficiency of the certificate of merit that was attached to the second amended petition. First amended petition, February 22nd. I believe the second amended petition was March 2nd. So in a leap year, I think that was 9 days. Of course, the PACL decision cited in our brief notes that set of circumstances is really irrelevant to the Certificate of Merit statute because it requires, by its express terms, the filing with the initial complaint. To the knowledge of appellants, every court that's considered that issue says, yeah, it's mandatory, it has to be attached to the first pleading you file against the engineering or, you know, the registered professional that you name in your lawsuit. And again, dismissal for failure to do so is mandatory unless you meet the one exception.
But now, what impact does it have where the statute allows dismissal with or without prejudice?
Well,
so, I mean, you just basically do a do-over, right?
The appellants have not found a lot of cases that discuss that particular issue, but that does appear to be the case because it gives the court discretion with really no guidance as to which it should do to either dismiss with prejudice or without prejudice. And of course, as this court is aware and some other courts are aware, frequently the courts are deprived of jurisdiction because the plaintiff will simply non-suit the defendant and render the appeal moot in the court without jurisdiction, and I think this court has dismissed one of those. So it does appear that you get a do-over. But what the plaintiffs in this case, the appellees, really tried to do and really tried to argue to the trial court was that, well, this isn't really engineering. and therefore we didn't really even have to file a certificate of merit in the first place. In fact, that's the only change, only real substantive change between the First Amendment petition and the Second Amendment petition was the addition of a paragraph that said, hey, just in case this was engineering, because we know these guys are engineers, we're attaching a certificate of merit. That's the only reason given in the Second Amendment petition for the failure to attach it to the First Amendment petition. And it should be noted that the certificate of merit is dated 2 days after the filing of the First Amendment petition. And there was really no reason, limitations-wise, for the filing of the petitions at that time. At any rate, we feel that the pleadings, which are what the court should look to, the plaintiff's pleadings, adequately demonstrate that the practice of engineering is sufficiently implicated. And the reason is that basically these defendants engineered the foundation for this home. And what the plaintiffs allege the reason they're liable is that they failed to go out and inspect and make sure that it was constructed the way they had designed it. That's the real gravamen of the plaintiff's issue with these defendants. And that clearly implicates the practice of engineering. Now, in our brief, we note that the statute is kind of interesting because although it's a statute about architects and engineers, it does not say that the defendant had to be providing professional engineering services. It just uses the phrase professional services. And so we spend some time in the brief noting that, I mean, the legislature could have said professional engineering or architectural services. They just said professional services. And we spend some time in the brief talking about what is professional services. But the cases have consistently put engineering between professional and services, even though the statute does not, and look to the Occupations Code definition of the practice of engineering to determine whether the defendant was performing engineering professional services such that the statute applies. We feel, again, that the plaintiff's pleadings, definitely implicate the practice of engineering. We cite ultimately a trilogy of cases. The Sardari case, which held that an architect's design and construction oversight of a building was involved such that when a woman walked through the door and cut herself on the frame, that she needed to file a certificate of merit when she brought the lawsuit. The UOP case, I think, is unreported, but it simply said that an engineer's design of a lawsuit alleging exposure to asbestos sufficiently implicated the practice of engineering because the engineer would have had to known about asbestos when it designed and engineered the plant that it built. And then finally, in our reply brief, we cite a recent case. It's VR and Sons versus CIVE, C-I-V-E, engineering. And in that case, the engineer, very similar to this case, all he was doing was going out and looking at the construction to make sure it was built properly, but mostly just to make sure that the contractor could get paid. So he was signing off on payment approval forms. Mm-hmm. And the owner of the property first sued the contractor, and then, like in this case, added the engineering firm and allege, hey, you didn't oversee the contractor well enough, which is exactly what the plaintiffs allege in this case, that Americo Housing, which built the foundation, was not sufficiently overseen by RCS and James Martin Montgomery when, you know, it built the foundation for the home.
In this case, RCS allegedly is the one who also created the plan and the design for the foundation?
Yes, it's actually the attachment to the Certificate of Merit that was the first Certificate of Merit, and it shows RCS Engineering as the designer, signed off by a different engineer than Mr. Montgomery. As the plaintiffs allege, and I think it's factually correct, Mr. Montgomery is the principal owner and director, manager of RCS.
Okay, and can this statute require a certificate of merit for other types of, quote, professional services? And if so, besides architects and engineers, are there other kinds of cases like I don't know, non-medical?
It's the only statute that I'm aware of outside of the medical context. It does include land surveyors by its express terms, I believe. But
like, say you have a licensed electrician, I believe they have some pretty strict licensing requirements. Would that type of claim, a claim against an electrician, be covered under the statute?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I believe it only applies to architects, engineers, and land surveyors.
Okay.
I can.
Thank you. That's okay. Thanks.
So the statute applies the practice of because the practice of engineering was involved here, and the appellee's failure to file a certificate of merit requires dismissal. In response, they raise they try to raise a mootness argument that they had basically non-suited their claims against Mr. Montgomery. As I read the third amended petition, which actually was filed after the hearing of this motion to dismiss, so shouldn't really be relevant to the motion to dismiss, it still includes Mr. Montgomery as a defendant, and even it includes it a negligence claim, although the response brief indicated they had dropped the negligence claim against Mr. Montgomery. You know, part of this whole problem is the history of the statute. When it was first enacted, it just said negligence. The legislature tried to amend it in 2005 to include other claims. There was a big split among the Court of Appeals about, well, does it or does it not apply to non-negligence claims? And then in 2009, we think the legislature finally made it extremely clear, as I think the Pro Plus case indicates, that yes, it applies to all claims of any kind against an engineer. As long as the practice of engineering is involved. the other response in the brief, perhaps worth noting, is constitutional claims that if you enforce the statute against us for based on our failure to file it with the initial complaint, we're deprived of pursuing a claim with merit, and that violates open courts and equal protection. In the medical liability statute context, that has been consistently rejected. And we note that in the reply brief. And I would say that the final argument in the response brief was a suggestion that the engineering defendants had waived their right to dismissal under the certificate of merit statute based on trial proceedings. That has been routinely rejected. I think only recently was it? I think it was this court in Murphy versus Gutierrez that held that a waiver occurred. The first reply to the waiver argument, it was never raised in the trial court. It's new on this appeal. And secondly, if you look at the totality of the cases, the engineering defendants may have served or responded to written discovery prior to the hearing on the motion to dismiss, but that's all they did, and they filed the motion to dismiss immediately, and it was heard within a few months of its filing. So for these reasons, we ask that the order of the trial court denying the motion to dismiss be reversed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lindstrom. Mr. Jacobini.
Good morning.
Morning.
Let me try and address some of the questions that Justice Livingston addressed to Mr. Lindstrom. The second amended petition was, in fact, served on RCS and Mr. Montgomery 12 days after the original petition was filed. And as far as the reason why there was no certificate of merit attached to the original petition, is that initially I had tried to contact the engineer we retained because there was an ongoing arbitration suit arbitration matter involving Oak Creek, the builder. And in discovery, he designated that there was a responsible third party, AmeriCo Housing. And then he'd also answered discovery saying that the TPI, the third party inspector, was RCS and Montgomery. That was mid-February of 2012. So I had a preliminary report that was dated March 3rd of 2010. We had negligence claims that were pled, and we also had fraud claims that were pled. So Mr. Hogue, our engineer, was out of state. I tried to contact him, call, email. I couldn't get him. And also had gotten charged with an approved third-party inspector. Third-party inspectors are required to be approved by the Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation. So the third-party inspector I'd spoken with said that, no, you don't have to have any special knowledge, training, or education in engineering to adequately perform the services of a TPI for what's called a site inspection. So given the date on the preliminary report, that being public record, and it also disclosing that there was a site inspection that had been performed, and also disclosing that the foundation was not constructed in accordance with the foundation plan, I was alarmed that that could be a possible triggering date under the discovery rule. Didn't want it to be a triggering date, but it certainly could be. Nobody knows when. It's a question of fact when plaintiffs Hilton's should have discovered that a TPI inspection was made and performed and that the injury resulting from that. So we pled the discovery rule. But after we'd filed the original petition, well, it's actually called the first amended petition, had to file the original petition to get Oak Creek to go to arbitration. Then I was able to reach Mr. Hogue. Mr. Hogue basically said the same thing that the approved TPI had said, and also that if Mr. Montgomery or somebody else who was an engineer could come up and say engineering services were required, then you'd need a supporting affidavit. So, but I was concerned right then at that time with negligence claims because those are a 2-year statute of limitation. Looking at the March 3rd, 2010 preliminary draft being public record, then I was concerned that that could lead to a bar date under limitations. So we filed without the certificate of merit. And then, after that filing, I spoke with Mr. Hogue. Mr. Hogue alerted me to that. I needed his affidavit on other things as well, a fraud count involving Mr. Montgomery supposedly made a representation supposedly that the settlement was normal settlement to the home. It didn't have any foundation problems, or at least these damages were not being caused by foundation problems. But I filed the second amended petition after I got a very quick draft from notes and briefly talking with Mr. Hogue. I sent him the draft email. He signed it, got it notarized, sent it back to me, and I got it on February 28th. And I think I filed the second amended petition March 2nd of 2012. That being the original petition being filed about 9 days before limitations might expire if you used, for negligence claims, if you used March 3rd, 2010 is an accrual date for negligence claims. The other matter which was addressed was that RCS did the foundation design and RCS was the TPI. Well, there's no evidence in the record about RCS having any kind of contract as part of its performance of the design services that it would do third-party inspection work. And what we've alleged and what Mr. Hogue confirms is that the TPI did not go out and perform an inspection, and then the TDLR rules require the TPI, if they notice a non-conforming construction defect with the foundation, to post what's called a deviation notice and then to file reports with the TDLR. It's virtually our position that failure to post the deviation notice and or failure to file these reports with the TDLR is tantamount to an overt representation that the subject property complies with the requirements of the foundation plan. What the TPI is accused of not doing in this case is inspecting to see that the footings, which are trenches basically that are dug in which to pour concrete in and steel to create what's called concrete runners, were not verified to be 12 inches or more into undisturbed soil. That the TPI did not verify that tests were showing that engineered fill material, as required by the foundation drawings, had been used for fill, and failed to see if tests had been made showing that the material had been compacted to what's called a 95% standard Proctor density test. That doesn't mean that the TPI has to perform a standard Proctor density test. That's done in a laboratory. Looking at the test, though, and seeing that the tests were done is something that the TPI should have done. And Mr. Hogue says it wasn't.
Can I ask a probably silly question, but is it usual for this third-party inspector to be affiliated with or employed by the firm that designed the foundation plan? I mean, to me, that makes it not a third party.
That's our point. That's one of the real strong points as far as the issue about the fraud and fraudulent concealment arguments. The TDLR has not taken any action yet, again, in this case, and I've not made any complaint to the State Board of Engineers yet. I hope I answered the question.
Thank you.
As far as non-suiting, what we did in the brief and in the pleading, once they had responded to discovery and said that, well, it wasn't Mr. Montgomery that was the TPI, and they meaning RCS and Mr. Montgomery now saying they weren't the TPI, then we amended our claims to delete the negligence and fraud claim against Mr. Montgomery with respect to his conduct as a TPI, but not with respect to the fraud or the negligent claims involving a misrepresentation as to the home problems being the result of normal settlement. We did file the certificate of merit within the time required for what's called the auto limitations exception. 150.02 actually has two exceptions. First exception being what we're calling an auto limitations exception is that if you file within 10 days from the date limitations will expire and you're unable to get your affidavit, what we're calling a certificate of merit, from your engineer within that time, then you've got 30 days automatically to obtain that affidavit. There's no requirement under the 150.02 for a defendant, engineer, architect, or land surveyor to answer the suit until the 30 days after they have been served with the affidavit. It's expressly provided by the statute. We're saying that it's really not professional services that were involved, because what you had is you had somebody that would have to look at the natural grade and then look at the amount of the fill, and then they could look at the, make a measurement of the depth of the footing, and you could see if you were 12 inches or not into undisturbed soil. Mr. Hogue's affidavit shows it's not 12 inches into undisturbed soil. Mr. Hogue's affidavit shows that there was no 95% Proctor density test compaction. Mr. Hogue's affidavit shows that fill material was not select engineered fill. If you look at the other documents that the court had before it, then you could also, the other thing is that the anchor bolts, which tie down the home, which sits on a frame, which in turn sits on the concrete runners, had, according to the foundation, had to be embedded 5 inches into the concrete minimum. Well, these were only embedded 3 inches into concrete minimum. And Mr. Hogue was saying you don't have to have an engineer to take a measurement on a bolt or see how far it goes into the concrete. You don't have to have any kind of specialized education, knowledge, training in engineering sciences to be able to adequately perform those services at the TPI. There was no other evidence offered in rebuttal to that. I see my time is up. I don't want the wrath of my son upon me, so I will yield the podium.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobini. Now it's Marshall Jacobini, correct?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. my role in this brief was very limited, as I am a young attorney, and so I'm very happy to actually be able to speak to you guys in my first year of practice. But I will let you know that what I'm planning on really addressing here is the constitutional arguments that were raised in the brief. And basically, what it boils down to here is if the court reverses the trial court's decision here, then it's going to be adopting an interpretation of 150.002, the Certificate of Merit statute, that would violate the due process provisions of the Texas and United States constitutions. However, per rules of statutory interpretation, 150.002 can be and should be construed under an interpretation that would avoid constitutional conflict, and that would be able to be done by simply affirming the trial court's judgment here. As you've probably already gathered, Your Honors, is that the appellant's interpretation of the Certificate of Merit statute is that there's actually no separate good cause exception. I believe my father mentioned that we argue that there's two different exceptions, the automatic limitations extension and then the general good cause exception. And under that, well, basically, the trial court disagreed with that argument, because that argument was also made before the trial court. And the trial court, in its order, specifically stated that it found there was a good cause exception, the generalized one, and that in this case, good cause was shown, and that the certificate of merit that was actually considered by the trial court was found to be sufficient. So, basically, the major rule that I try and get into at the beginning of the brief that really kind of deals with the situation is that the statute, the way the appellant is requesting this court read it and interpret it, basically creates an irrebuttable presumption that it deprives the party of, you know, proceeding with their meritorious claim. And the rule stated in Clem, which is an older case, but the holding's been approved by the Texas Supreme Court, is that statute, in that case, there was a statute that basically created an irrebuttable presumption depriving the defendant of all but a limited defense to fraud. And what the court had basically said there is that when you deny the party the right to try and rebut that presumption in any way, shape, or form, it's a denial of their due process rights.
All right, Mr. Jacobini, unfortunately your time is up.
Oh, thank you. Sorry.
That's all right. We appreciate it. Thank you. All right, Mr. Lindstrom, rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, pleases the court and counsel. With respect to the constitutional argument raised for the first time on appeal, I don't know of any basis that allows them, just because it's a constitutional argument, to raise it for the first time on appeal. Secondly, they don't cite to the analogous medical liability statute, and as we note in page 10 of our reply brief, for good reason. I'll quote from Brockstrom versus Carson, which is a 2010 Dallas petition denied case. Specifically, the appellant asserts that the statute is unconstitutional as applied to her because her claim is not frivolous and the goal of the statute is to prevent and or discourage frivolous lawsuits. And there's an ellipse. Every court that has considered whether the expert report requirement passes constitutional muster has concluded that it does. And we cite other cases that, you know, talk about it doesn't offend due process, doesn't offend open courts. The appellees do not cite to any case that has construed the constitutionality of any expert report statute, and certainly not the certificate of merit statute. So we think those arguments are without merit and should be rejected by the court. The main thrust seems to be from the appellees is that, look, there was this report, and it's dated March 3rd of 2010, and 2 years from that is March 3rd, 2012, and that is supposedly why we filed when we did. It's important to consider all of the facts behind that. First of all, it bears a fax header of May 26, 2010, apparently from maybe perhaps Mr. Hilton to counsel. But in their trial court pleadings, they acknowledge getting the report on May 26, 2010. So they had it for almost 2 years before they decided to go ahead and file against the engineering defendants. What they told the trial court is, what we're really concerned about is that March 26, 2010. If you read the reporter's record, counsel informed the trial court, Judge, we really need a ruling by May 26 because that's when we got that report and that's the important triggering date for the statute of limitations. There was really no briefing or argument in the trial court that, well, really it's the date of March 3rd, 2010 on that report that concerns us. But those dates and when they filed should be analyzed in context. If March 3rd, 2010 was the date, why not wait until you get your certificate of merit and then file before then? But they chose, for whatever reason, to file on February 22nd, 2010, without a certificate of merit. And under the statute, as technical as it might be, and if you look at Sharp Engineering versus Louise, the concurring opinion noted that it was a trap for the unwary, but that's what the statute says. One case has created a good cause exception. That's the WCM case out of Corpus Christi. All the cases subsequent to that say that's really kind of butchered statutory construction. If you read section 150.002C, it clearly has one exception. We cite a trilogy of cases, Apex from Texarkana of June of this year, EPCO Holdings from the Houston court, and then Nangia versus Taylor, which I think was Beaumont. And all those cases say, if you're filing to get that exception, there's not a good cause exception. It's the exception that's stated in the statute. And because it's a 30-day extension, you have to allege that you didn't file with a certificate of merit within 30 days of your initial complaint. You don't have to make that allegation in the initial complaint, but you at least have to make it within 30 days, and they did not do that. The first time they mentioned that they filed on February 22nd out of, quote, concern for the statute of limitations was on May 9th. In their filing, responding to the motion to dismiss, which was well beyond what would have been the 30-day extension. So there's no good cause exception. They didn't meet the exception that's stated in the statute. Practice of engineering was clearly implicated, and the failure to file a certificate of merit with the initial complaint is fatal, and the case should have been dismissed. And for those reasons, we ask that this court reverse the trial court and either enter a judgment of dismissal or direct the trial court to enter a judgment of dismissal. Thank you.
And if we were to do so, would you recommend dismissal with or without prejudice?
Your Honor, it's tough to say because, frankly, the appellants didn't find any cases that really talk about what should guide the trial court's decision in that regard. The statute doesn't give any. I'm not aware of any legislative history that really informs that decision. It's apparently up to the trial court to do as it sees fit. Obviously, as the defendants, we'd prefer with prejudice so that the claim can't be brought, but it can be either way.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lindstrom. And thank you both, Mr. Jacobinis, for being here. We appreciate your arguments and all of your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted. You are excused, and we will take a short recess to pick up at 10:30 for our 1:10:30 case. Thank you.